Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2021. The Historical Novel Society Australasia acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live. We pay respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. In this season of Imagining the Past, we'll take a sneak peek at writers and issues showcased at this year's Historical Novel Society Australasia's virtual conference, which will be held over two successive weekends on the 16th and 17th of October and the 22nd to 24th of October 2021. The online conference offers boot camps and craft workshops, with the main conference program featuring 2 days of interviews, panels and chat salons for both writers and readers of historical fiction. For more information, please visit hnsa.org.au. In our upcoming podcast, I'll be chatting with some of the conference guests about their work and their inspirations. So pop on the kettle, pop on your headphones, and let's start imagining the past. Julie Jansen is a Barabarongal woman of Darug Nation. She is a highly acclaimed playwright, poet, and novelist. Her most recent novel, Benevolence, published by Mugabala Press 2020, is to be published in the USA and UK by HarperCollins. I started by welcoming Julie to Imagining the Past.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here. I'd like to give an acknowledgement of country. I live and work in Maruya on the south coast of New South Wales, and I acknowledge that I live on the land of the Yuin Brinja people and that I give respect to elders past, present and emerging.
What was your first inkling that you had to become a writer?
Oh, good question. I think a lot of people always answer that question with, I put on plays as a child, which of course is my answer as well. I only ever saw a couple of pantomimes as a child. My family was quite poor, but we had an aunt who was had a minor roles in pantomimes, and I remember going to see some pantomimes and being absolutely blown away by Cinderella or anything like that. And it was more the theatre that totally engaged me as a child rather than the thought of writing, although I did write a lot of poetry, bad poetry, in my teens, but I never saw myself as a writer. I was a visual artist, really. I made puppets and masks and costumes and wrote plays at university and had a lot of theatre productions at University of New South Wales, and I did all the costumes and acted as well. But writing, no, I didn't really see myself as a writer until I was almost 40.
Wow. And what was the turn into that? What inspired you?
Well, you know, when I was living in the Northern Territory on remote communities, I was in the community of Galawinku on Elko Island in Arnhem Land for a couple of years, and I ended up having the role of an English teacher with the upper school, and I started writing plays with the children so they could put on a concert, and we made some kind of crazy plays. One of them was, and it was all about the children's ideas, you know, they're teenagers. And one of them they wrote was Count Dracula and the Indians. And I'd say that would have been one of my first plays that I wrote with the children, and it was a great hit. And we made all the costumes and batik costumes and masks out of paper mache and things like that. And the climax of the play was that the Dracula has killed a whole lot of Indians, which were all the beautiful girls dressed in feathers and Indian, American Indian clothing. And they came back to life, and they came back to life as skeletons, and they came out from underneath the school building where we were performing as our stage. And the audience of 400 people got up screaming and left and ran off back to the home, and we were just all standing there on the stage with no one in the audience except a couple of camp dogs. And at that moment I thought, gee, theatre's powerful. Writing kind of started then. It was more writing down plays that often I would do in a context as a drama teacher. I was a trained drama teacher from the University of New South Wales. And I'd write plays with groups of people, Aboriginal people, always with Aboriginal groups, yeah.
And what was the turn into writing novels or more prose than performance pieces?
Well, I think I'll just quickly say that the writing the plays was my first love, and And I began to get plays on at theatres like Belvoir Street Theatre, which have had very few women playwrights and none, I think, of Indigenous descent. And I wrote about 10 plays, and some plays are still performed in places like Indonesia. One I wrote about the Macassan traders coming from Makassar in Sulawesi and travelling to the north of Australia to trade with Aboriginal people. That play was on at the studio of the Opera House about 6 years ago. So plays was my passion, but I had a couple of plays shortlisted for the Patrick White Award, which never got productions. And I was kind of heartbroken. You know, a play can take you just as long as a novel to write. It can take 2-3 years, plus you've got all the workshopping with actors and trying to get the funding to help you workshop, etc. And for them not to get productions, and instead, you know, the theatre company would be putting on Chekhov or some bloody thing. And so I was really kind of heartbroken that I couldn't get these plays on, even though they'd been shortlisted for major awards. So at that stage, I thought, look, I'll try novel writing. It must be easier. Well, unfortunately, it wasn't.
And so what was the first inkling you had to write Benevolent?
Oh, gosh. Well, the family story that I came to learn, I got myself a job with Professor Peter Reed, who's a very old friend of mine, who worked very much with Stolen Generation people, and him and Coral Edwards started Link Up. And Peter Reed's a very good friend of mine. He gave me this job as a senior researcher on a project called the History of Aboriginal Sydney. .edu.au, which is still available online, this enormous website. And I had the job of going out and researching by either working in libraries, but also going and interviewing elders, people from as far north as the Blue Mountains to Singleton to La Perouse, all over Sydney. But he especially gave me the western region of Sydney to look at, because he knew that that was where my family came from. And I knew very, very little about my Aboriginal family history. Dad died when he was 43, and Dad didn't know much himself. And so I had this great opportunity to talk to all these elders in these areas, and their stories were so similar to my dad's stories, family stories, that I realised that I was actually uncovering my own family history by proxy, as it were, by interviewing all of these elders. And then when we finished that 5-year project, and I still kept, you know, writing other things at the time, plays, etc., I thought, look, this is going to be a great novel, these stories. And I thought, oh, someone will be in somewhere like London and they'll look at this website and go, why? Marvellous stories. I think I'll write a novel. And I thought, I better get in first and write the story of the Aboriginal family that began at Bushells Lagoon. That's what I know about Dad's family. Mary Thomas was born at Bushells Lagoon, which is just near Richmond, not far from Windsor, not far from Wilberforce. And there was a camp there called the Blacktown Road Camp. Nowhere near Blacktown. It predated the actual Blacktown, of all things. It was called Blacktown Road. And that is where there was a camp, and that's where Mary Thomas was born. So when I found out that information, I was able to then begin to kind of research the family. And it was such a great story of survival down through the women line, following, you know, from great, great, three times great grandma right down to my grandma when I, you know, who's passed away now, that I thought, oh, that's the story that I want to write. So, but I think there's going to be a sequel to Benevolence. Yeah.
Oh.
I'm thinking of it. Yeah. The Next Generation.
I'm always interested in the decisions authors make, you know, when you're planning a novel, and one of the biggest ones is choosing point of view. So I'm just wondering if you could walk us through your decisions around choosing the point of view and how you deployed point of view in the novel.
Yeah. It's a really important one. I think I learnt as a playwright. Well, as a playwright, you get to depict a lots of different points of views. So But I did learn that it was so much easier to have one main point of view. And I attempted to do that, but it doesn't always work. Sometimes the omniscient author does slip in with benevolence, and I'm aware of that, but luckily not too many editors pulled me over the coals about it, so I was grateful for their editorial kindness. Without editors, I don't know where we'd be. The point of view of Mary became really important, Murrugging, because this story had never really been told. We've read lots of books, novels, histories about Aboriginal people, some about the Hawkesbury River. But it's always a point of view from a white person's point of view. And I was really interested in finding out the woman's story. And I've always put women centre stage in my plays, so I thought centre stage in a novel too is the way to go, yeah.
And what was the decisions around using third person rather than a more intimate first person?
Well, the next one's going to be a more intimate first person. That's the result of that decision. I just think first person will... I had it in my mind that if it's first person, there's so many things you can't tell, because if the first person's not experiencing the events, then you can't talk about the events except in terms of, you know, what they heard or what they saw. And so in my mind, it was really important to have lots of different voices happening. And so, but making sure that she was at the centre of the stories and how she perceived them. But, it's like a dreadful juggling act in the end. And the next book, I can tell you, will be in first person past tense.
Well, that leads me to my next question of why did you use present tense? I'm always very, very interested in why people select present tense.
Now, Greg, you've got the thorniest of questions. These are terrible questions when the book's already out there.
I'll take that as a compliment.
I still have a little bit of regret about that. Once you've decided these things, you kind of, it's like written in stone and you can't deviate, as you know. You just have to keep on ploughing through. Present tense is also very difficult to sustain, I hope to bring people more into the immediacy of her experience. I have got quite a lot of dialogue in benevolence because of my background as a playwright, and they were some of the areas that certain editors and publishers wished to cut down, and I had to fight. And for somebody, it was my first professionally published novel, so fighting doesn't come easy to someone who's really keen to get it published. But to say, look, no, the dialogue's really important to me, I'm going to keep the dialogue as much as I can. I love writing dialogue.
Yeah, and I think the dialogues really work in many, many different directions. And it also allows an intimacy, because you are like a play, you are actually in there with the characters.
Yes. Yeah.
But also it allows the reader to interpret, which is, I guess, what happens in performance as well to a large degree.
Yeah.
Does the present tense reflect the Darug language at all? Does that language have past tenses and things?
It does, but I'm not a linguist, but Darug language has been fairly poorly recorded over the years. We only have some very narrow word lists, but we do have word lists even going back as far as the Lieutenant Dawes in Sydney, called the Sydney language, which is mostly Darug language. But the word lists are quite narrow, so... interpreting, but there is a past and a present tense, but the availability of a proper grammatical kind of understanding is not available to people who wish to use Darug language, whereas if you go to somewhere like Bundjalung, you've got a complete kind of language dictionary to choose from. So no, it's hard, and I sometimes imagine some ancestors coming back, standing behind my computer and just roaring with laughter and slapping their thighs at some ghastly kind of combination of words that I've put together. Anyway.
So the language is not spoken at all, or has it been reconstituted?
It's reconstituted. It's part of the wonderful renewal of Aboriginal culture and people's awareness of their cultural backgrounds, that not only language but ceremony and cultural practice and traditional foods and things, even in people living in urban settings, like like I have. This kind of renewal is also meant for a great renewal in the interest in language. But I've always used Aboriginal language before anyone else kind of much was using it, except of course the great Jack Davis always put in quite a few Noongar words in his plays. I always stressed to use language when I wrote the play Black Mary. I spent quite a bit of time with elders up in Taree to get permission to use Biripi language and put quite a bit of Biripi language into that play. And the elders were absolutely delighted to hear that language, and they came down to, part of the Belvoir Street production of Black Mary, and they, 20 of them stood up and shook my hands and said, "Thank you for including the language." So, I just think, we need to renew the language as much as we possibly can. Yeah.
There must have been a huge diversity in languages across the continent, not just obviously different languages, but just how those languages were actually constructed and put together.
Yeah, I think it's be another whole interview about language. When I lived at Elko Island, there were 17 different groups living on Elko Island, which is a fairly small island, had been brought together by a missionary, basically to protect people because there was so much killing and massacring going on in Arnhem Land. And Bappa shepherds and used to stand on the beach with a rifle, and if any lugger or pearl lugger or men with guns arrived, he just fire the gun in the air and they take off. But there were 17 languages there. I mean, there's all different kind of, people might refer to them as dialects, but some of them are quite separate languages.
Yeah.
Great diversity of language all over the country.
The novel's title is incredibly multifarious. I think I just would be interested in hearing quickly about your path to that title.
Yeah, well, when I first began the novel, I was really going to write about Mary Thomas, my, two times great grandma, she had children removed from her and taken by the Benevolent Society in 1862, I think, and three of those children were never seen again. Fanny, Mary, and I think the boy was called William. Those children were never seen again after the Benevolent Society took them. And when I looked up the Benevolent Society records, it said children given by the mother unable to care for them, father in the insane asylum. And when I read that record, and there's the handwriting and the beautiful script of that particular time, I felt this terrible kind of anguish because the older sister of these children is the great grandma. Who is remembered in my family, and her daughter used to sit in the sun and watch us play as kids. So it's kind of this realizing that you've got people that were removed in your own family in that particular era. And so I thought the benevolence of English people towards Aboriginal people has always been such a two-edged sword, and it's an ironic title. But then once I started writing the novel, I found that I was wanting to go back much further to the original Aboriginal woman, Darug woman on the river, and I never quite got to the scene where the Benevolent Society takes the children. So, but the benevolence of setting up the native school in Parramatta by Governor Lachlan Macquarie and his wife Elizabeth, I think that was done with a benevolent and open heart of what they wanted. But of course, a lot of those children were the children that they'd acquired through Macquarie sending a punitive party to Appin, where they massacred, we don't know, maybe up to 100 Gundungurra people, and saved some of the children to bring back so Mrs. Macquarie could start a little school. So it's a strange benevolence.
Given that you've got a highly diverse range of characters in the novel, I'm just wondering too about your process of drilling down into each of those characters' subjectivities, because you have like a huge cast of very, very different people.
Well, it's always the trick of a novelist, I think, and a playwright, to try to bring some major characters. If you've got them at the beginning of the novel, you really need to know what happens to them at some stage in the novel. Bring them back in the end. So, because this novel traverses time, starts when she's a little girl about seven and ends when she's in her, late 30s. You've got a lot of changing governors, you've got a lot of changing military. So there were a couple of military figures that I was quite interested in, like a man called Captain Wallace, who actually began the establishment of Newcastle. And he's the character that my Lieutenant Woodrow is based on. And but I realised if I actually used a real historical person, one, you've got the problem of descendants coming after you with, he didn't do that, or he wasn't responsible for that massacre. And so it's sometimes easier to create a character out of a blend of characters that you've read historically, and just keep the main historical governors, etc., which are, you know, you can't refute the fact that they were there in, you know, 1817 and left in 1823 or something like that. So to choose, it's once again, it's the playwriting skills, I think, coming forward, that, you know, that I've got this kind of coterie of characters. You know, Mercy, the best friend of Mary, who keeps reappearing and is kind of like the naughty older sister. I've never had a sister. I would have loved to have had a naughty older sister. So, you know, there was Mercy, and then there's the Reverend, of whom she has a relationship with. And I kind of brought a lot of them back in the last few scenes. And that is it's like the skills of a playwright. It's what you do. You make a kind of a cyclic journey to some of the major characters, and it's more emotionally satisfying to know what happened to people. Yeah.
So given our conversation today is in the lead up to the Historical Novel Society Australasia's conference, I'm just wondering if you could outline some of the challenges you think are unique to writing First Nations historical fiction.
Well, the terms, you know, writing literature for restorative justice, I think, is a good term. There are many Indigenous artists across the world, really, who create their art in order to draw attention to the injustices of the past. And I think I've always been driven to have that political edge, even if it put some readers off. I'm not a person who can ever sit down and just write a nice romantic story, I'm afraid. I think because when I was only 21, I went to live on the Burke Reserve up on Darling River, or near the Burke Reserve, I should say. And I was so shocked to see the conditions people were living in, you know, 400 people with one tap and two toilets and living under bits of tin. And I couldn't believe that this country treated its Aboriginal people in such a way, because I'd had the privilege of living in a housing commission house, grew up with Dad, who never really talked about being Aboriginal. He worked two jobs, as a fire brigade, in the fire brigade, and as a stonemason. And you know, we were poor, but we, you know, we had a house, we had, you know, I went to school, I had opportunities. And I think after going to Burke and then following up going to Arnhem Land and living on an Aboriginal cattle station where people were just treated like animals, basically. Guy station manager would even take a whip to people if he felt like it. It changed me forever, those few early years in my mid-20s and early 20s. And I, from then on, whatever artistic pursuit I had, I knew they had to have this kind of edge of fighting back against that kind of injustice that was in front of us every single day in Australia. And we don't want to acknowledge it, but it just, you know, we've got to have some kind of justice. There's got to be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. People need apologies. People need to be compensated. And I just think we've come a hell of a long way in this country, but I can't, that's the kind of writing I have to do. I can't stop myself.
Is it possible to recover kind of very old stories though, like from the pre-colonial era? Which would be historical fiction, yeah.
Invent. Okay. I just think all we can do is invent, really. I mean, you know, there's some wonderful examples of fabulous historical novelists, whether it's in England or America or whatever. I mean, you know, and marvellous Australian examples as well. But, you know, you play a bit of a dangerous game because, you know, people will always come out saying, it wasn't in 1833, it was 1835, with this kind of great sense of kind of indignity about, you know, how dare you get the date wrong. I just kind of laugh that kind of thing off. I just think, you know, it's Australia's history is complex and fascinating, and a lot of it is kind of untold. And I'm not surprised that people don't want to know the stories. A lot of them are absolutely ghastly. But I just think they need to be told, but told with a humanity. You know, not all white people are evil monsters. Not all Aboriginal people are saints. We're all human beings, and we all are products of our particular time and era and social circumstances. And I try to kind of uncover that kind of humanity in each person, even if they're a murderer. Yeah.
You've hinted at this in some things you've already said, but in other creative arts areas like dance and visual art particularly, it's like First Nations people have really stamped themselves on those forms. I'm just wondering if you think that with First Nations historical fiction, the writers are kind of emerging into a new arena in a way.
Yeah, I think that's definitely so. Certainly a lot more people are having a go at it, and with more or less success, depending on their particular skill set or their interests. I think it's great that so many First Nations people are having a go. I've been actually working with a writer. I won't need to mention her name, but I can actually, Lenora Thacker, and she's a new writer from Cairns who's of Torres Strait Island descent and Jamaican descent. And her story is fascinating because no one's ever written anything like about that particular history of Torres Strait Islander people living on the mainland. And it's an amazing story. I just think there's so many stories that need to be uncovered. And I find that there's also a bit of a rush for non-Indigenous writers to take parts of Indigenous stories and plant them in their novel to give it a bit of colour. And that's a complex area that needs a really good discussion about cultural appropriation or various things. But I think, you know, the horse has already bolted from the stable on that one. And I just hope that people do do the appropriate protocols and pay respect to Aboriginal people who actually own those stories.
Yeah. Do you think with these emerging writers, I always kind of feel like when a new form exists or something new happens, there's a lot of pressure put on it that it's got to be perfect, you know, and it's got to knock the socks off everyone. Do you feel like there needs to be a middle ground with this kind of emerging First Nations historical fiction where people are allowed to experiment with the form and the content in order to find, you know, more successful ways of representing things?
That is once again a complex question. I think that there should be more support from mainstream publishers. I think the getting published, ending up in the slush pile problem is a major problem for First Nations writers. People would claim that that's not true, and they point out the various bright lights that have won wonderful prizes or have scooped all of the main prizes. And there's some terrific novels out there, you know, Nadi Simpson's The Song of the Crocodile, beautiful novels, done very well. But I just think, you know, I had a huge amount of trouble getting published. You're not supposed to admit that when you're trying to pretend you're a really successful writer, but you know, I've actually written two other novels, which I ended up self-publishing. I just find that I think the slush pile is kind of controlled by this cohort of middle-class non-Indigenous people who, I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of, it's not the word sympathy, is not the word I'm looking for. What is it? Enough understanding of the complexity of what it is for a lot of Aboriginal people, especially to get an education and get to the point where they can write a novel. It's up against huge challenges. Like, you know, I went to university, I couldn't afford to eat. I lived on Weet-Bix. You know, I just think they've got to accept that it's a very hard struggle. And when people get to the stage that they can write a historical novel or any kind of novel, and they come from a First Nations background, that they should get a bit of special treatment.
In preparing these questions today, I don't know why, but I kept thinking of the poet W.B. Yeats, who was very critical of the British occupation of Ireland and attempted to forge a kind of renewed pride in Irish folklore, but all of his work was written in English. So yes. I'm just wondering if you ever foresee that there'll be a First Nations historical fiction published in its originally in a First Nations language.
Well, I think the only readership you'd get for that would be somewhere like the Far Northern Territory, where languages are still very, very fluent, and people do like to read. I think you could. There are certainly many children's books written in First Nations languages up here at Elko Island. There were a lot of the children's early readers were all done in Djambawpinyu language, so it's certainly a possibility for communities that are, it's that these are still living first languages. Absolutely.
So what are you working on now? What's next?
Well, I've got the my novel, This River of Bones, which is a which is a novel set on the Darling River. It's contemporary. Originally, it wasn't, but now it's a contemporary novel, and it's about a female, an auntie June, her name is, and she's a Murray person, an Aboriginal person from the Darling River, and she's based on some of the aunts that I knew when I lived up there, and I've done quite a lot of looking into the protocols of talking about that part of the world with various elders from Menindee up to Moree. And it's about her fighting to protect the river, but also it involves two deaths in mysterious circumstances. So it's a bit of a, not so much a mystery as I guess a bit of a joining of genres of Aboriginal family goes to debutante ball and football match, tries to save the river, and also there's some two crimes. So it's, I guess, a blended genre, I suppose. It's been, yeah, been hell to write.
Will you return again to historical fiction, do you think?
Yes, yeah. As soon as I can get this one off to bed, I will. I'm going to write a sequel to Benevolence, is what I think I'm going to do, and I think it's going to be called The Crimes of Eleanor James. Yeah. Well, we'll see. Something
Well,
like that.
that's to look forward to. Look, I'd like to thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. It's
Thank you,
been
Greg. Yeah.
This episode features just one of over 70 speakers in our HNSA conference program. Our guest of honour is Geraldine Brooks. Other speakers include Stephen Carroll, Rosalie Hamm, and Kate Nunn, to name just a few. There'll also be special guest appearances from international best-selling authors Kate Quinn, Ben Kane, and Elizabeth Chadwick. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past.